Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started, because we don't want to miss out at all on our speaker today. We have a wonderful speaker visiting us from over at HBS, Mike Norton, Associate Professor, and I read Marvin Bauer Fellow, is that correct?
Which means they never told me what it means.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's clearly it's something that most associate professors do not have tagged onto their name, so an extra tag is a positive thing. Mike does fascinating research in so many areas. Today we're going to hear about some research that is actually a combination of some old work that he had done and brought together with some new work. And he's warned us that this is the maybe on the downer end of his work. But I also want to plug while I'm up here, he's got a book forthcoming on Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. And I don't think I'm giving away the bottom line to say that a big part of the message there is about spending money on others rather than yourself. And I share that just to give you a sense of the breadth of his work and his very positive message. So I'm sure you're going to find a way to be inspiring at the end.
That's a lot of pressure. So,
thank you so much for being here. We're very appreciative. And I meant to mention that, our first semester back, I'm supposed to mention that this is actually a jointly sponsored seminar. So here at the Women in Public Policy program, where we focus on gender gaps in political participation, economics, health, and education, and by the Center for Public Leadership. So thank you.
So thank you so much for having me. This is an intimidating microphone, but I'm gonna ignore it. It's like space age. So I do a lot of research actually on how to get people to be happier and healthier people. And then I also do a lot of research on the bad things that people sometimes do. And I thought I would, for whatever reason, talk about the bad stuff today. So I apologize. But I've always been interested in the funny ways that we basically justify and rationalize all the things that we do every day. And I mean at a big scale and also at a very low-level scale, the everyday kinds of behaviors that we do. So I'll try to talk about some of each of those today, kind of the systemic ways that we justify behavior that we might not like a lot, and also the little things that each of us does in our own everyday lives. So I just wanted to start by saying, that basically one of the reasons that this is so interesting to me is because people just do horrible things all the time, which we know. And I don't mean, again, major things even. I mean everyday little things. So these are just random things. This could be 50 slides of citations, but one of my favorite ones is Bella DiPaolo, who's a psychologist at the University of Virginia, recorded people's conversations, college students' conversations when they were in the cafeteria eating, and then she played them back to them and said, mark down every time you told something that wasn't true. And almost everyone lies all the time, just chatting at lunch, not even for a reason. You just lie. You're telling a story and you make a little bit of it up because it will be funnier. Or you sound a little bit cooler if you tell the story this way than that way. It's just insane how much we just habitually lie. Plagiarism is rampant. High school kids cheat all the time. At least one spouse will cheat. I don't know how exactly you measure that, but in 50 to 80% of marriages, then the joint probabilities are very disturbing also. But and people underreport all the time, of course, to the IRS. So that's fine, but and these things are all very interesting to me, but what I think is, to me, more interesting is this idea that we still feel that we're great. So we do these regrettable things all the time, and we walk around thinking, like, I'm a fantastic person. And that's what's so curious to me, the psychology of how we're able to do that. So this is just a quote from a dean about my students cheating, although it wasn't a survey at HBS, but they just sort of say, everyone cheats in business, so I have to learn how to cheat because then I'll be better at my job. It's a fascinating rationalization for why you're cheating is you're practicing a skill that you're going to need later in life. Everyone thinks that they have good ethics and character. Many of these studies, we all think we're better than average at everything. It's particularly pronounced often in the moral domain. So we think we're better at driving than other people, but we really think we're nicer people than other people. That's where we're sure everyone else here is horrible. Even if I ask you about in the room, you'll look around and you'll say, I'm definitely better than these people. You're probably really nice, I don't know, but we still have this thing in us like, well, he seems like a jerk and she looks like a weirdo, so. Is there a hand? Yeah.
Just on that first stat, when it says admit to cheating, like in what context, like on the schoolwork, or is it?
That was, I think, on some exams. Have you cheated on an exam? But people also cheat on schoolwork. By the way, I'm happy to take questions throughout, so feel free to throw your hand up at any point. I don't need to talk and then take questions.
You can Is there a gender difference, or are you going to answer that later?
I'm not going to talk actually about gender differences in the cheating, but I will talk about how some of these rationalizations play out with gender bias. People often think that women will be nicer than men, which in and of itself is a stereotype, but it turns out not so much. So we're all sort of horrible.
Are these American statistics?
Most of these are from America, yes. Do you have a theory for?
I was just wondering.
Like, do you think Canadians are moral, and it's the Americans that are?
I'd say a lot. It looks very American based.
Yeah. Okay. My guess is people are horrible everywhere. It's an empirical question. Okay. So. As I said, the really interesting thing to me is that we do bad things and then we feel okay about them. And so I want to talk about two different projects, one of which is older and one of which is newer, where we look at what happens. So given that you've done something questionable, what do you do next is the idea. And what you don't do is say, wow, I guess I'm a bad person. That seems very unlikely that that's the thing that we do. We do something to get rid of the fact that we did a bad thing. And one thing that we very often do is we make excuses for it, and I'll talk about some work that we've done in that domain, and you'll see how clever we are at figuring out how to justify the things we've done. And then I'll talk about some more recent research where we go even further and we actually deceive ourselves entirely about what we've done. And in some cases, we actually, when we do bad things, we infer, if anything, that we're better than we were instead of worse than we were. That's how good we are at making up stories in our head. Okay, so I want to start with a very, I said I want to do trivial and important things, so I want to start with a trivial thing. These are, I want to point out, male participants in an experiment we ran a few years ago. And we asked them to look at some sports magazines and tell us which sports magazine they liked. It's a pretty boring, simple test. So here's some information. There was more, but here's the basic stuff on these things. And what you can see is we rigged it a bit. So these attributes are fairly similar. And these ones, what we did was, you'll notice that the magazine on the left has more articles per issue than the magazine on the right. So it's better on that attribute. But the magazine on the right covers more sports than the magazine on the left. So each one, and who knows what these attributes really mean, but at least each one has one thing that's better and one thing that's worse than the other. And we set it up so that people are about 50-50, or nobody really has a preference, because who really cares about the sports and the articles and things like that. But then we did something a little bit sneaky, which is if you've ever gotten offers for sports magazines, they very often come with special issues. Can anybody think of a potentially biasing special issue that comes with some sports magazines that men? The swimsuit issue. Exactly. So what we thought was, now what if we threw a little thing on here where one of these came with an awesome swimsuit issue and one of them came with a boring special issue? And that's exactly what we did. So now we tell these guys, these are actually guys in college, but I doubt it would matter. We tell them that the magazine on the left, it turns out, comes with a swimsuit issue each year, and the magazine on the right comes with a cool thing, but it's like a football preview. Now we ask them again, which one do you want to choose? Now again, it was 50-50 before. The only thing that's changed is swimsuit versus football preview. What we see now is 92% of people pick this one, okay? Which is fine, nothing wrong with that. Seems like a good issue, things like that. But we ask them, rank the attributes and how important they were in your decision. And they tell us. So journalism, I don't know, was fifth, the articles per issue, something like that, whatever. What we're really interested in is the relative ranking of these two attributes. So they used to think those were about the same in importance in the version without these. Now, everybody says, well, you know, articles per issue is way more important in picking a magazine than the numbers. You see what they're doing there? It's very, very ingenious. And if we say, what about the special issue? Did that influence your decision? They say, oh, I didn't even notice. I really believe that the articles per issue is the number one thing. But then we do something sneakier, which is, as you may have guessed, flip it. So when we put it over here, now suddenly we get a preference for over here. And remember, it was 92% there. Now we're going all the way back to 59% here. And now suddenly everyone says, well, actually, the number of sports covered is, that's the good reason to buy a magazine. Not this other, who cares about articles per issue? That's just fluff. What we really need is more sports coverage, which again makes no sense because it's like what sport are you adding that you need? So we can really see, and again, I use this as a trivial example. In other domains, again, we could have women do similar things where they're justifying different kinds of decisions as well. But I like this because this is really one where you can imagine doing this all the time when you're making choices, that you're looking in the environment. You want to do a thing, and you can't really say you want to do the thing because of the thing. So you scan the environment really broadly and try to find something that allows you to say, oh, I did the thing for a different reason. It has nothing to do with that thing. It's the other thing that makes it okay. Yeah.
So do you think it's rationalizing behavior where the deception is taking place to the self? Or do you think that this is the same as when people are asked how much they listen to public radio or watch public TV, that they want to appear a little better to the outside world?
So here we don't know really well. Because they can imagine that we could look back and say, aha, I see what you did. In some of the later studies I'll talk about, it's more private. So at least sometimes it is all in your head, and sometimes there are these public concerns that happen. I'll also talk in a minute about how, imagine if I said while you're making this choice, after you finish, tell me why you did that. And I'll tell you what happens when we do that to people as well. You think it could de-bias people because they're going to have to come clean in public? Not so much. As it turns out. Other questions? Okay. So, trivial domain, important domain. Same. We'll use really the exact same paradigm, but we'll switch to a domain that's more important, which is gender bias. So we've done a few studies like this, so I'll just kind of walk you through one of them, sort of scenario studies where we ask people to engage in a simulated hiring decision. So in one of them, we basically said, imagine you're the manager of a cement manufacturing company. You can't spend too much time away. You need to hire someone to sell, basically. So we picked cement manufacturing because it sounded, I don't know what selling cement is. I don't know how you manufacture. Anyway, it sounded like a very male job, basically, cement manufacturing. And what we said was, well, as you make this decision, there's many things that are important in hiring someone. One of the things that's really important is someone with a strong knowledge of engineering, which means education. So they should be educated in engineering. And the other thing that we said was they really need experience and training, so they need experience in the industry as well. And what we're doing here, again, is we're setting up these two attributes, right? So just like we had a number of sports and number of articles, now we have experience is important and education is important. And then we can play with which candidates have which of those attributes that we said are very important to you. And the way that it works is, so we have two fictitious candidates, Lisa Rogers and Dan Redfield. If we don't put gender on this at all, again, choice is 50-50. So we always rig it so at baseline there's no preference between these candidates. But then we add gender. So Lisa Rogers, you can see, has their resumes are longer than this, but I'm just simplifying them to make it clear. Lisa Rogers has more experience than Dan Redfield, but Dan Redfield has more education than Lisa Rogers. Same exact paradigm as before where you can pick whoever you want and we're letting you figure out how to say it's not because of their gender. So what happens here? 75% of people choose the guy, and half of people rank education more than experience, the thing that he was higher on. Again, if we say, did gender play a role? They say absolutely not. They rank it last. They rank it last below attributes where we specifically said the candidates are exactly the same on them. Which makes that, how could that be more important than something that's different between them when you're choosing between people? But that's how reluctant people are to admit gender played any role. But again, as I showed you before, same thing, we flip the names. Now Dan Redfield is experienced and Lisa Rogers is educated. Now choice shifts over to the guy again. And now everybody says, well, actually it's experience that matters. And I'll tell you, it's amazing. We can write, we can leave an open-ended paragraph that says explain, you know, just not even publicly, just privately, explain why you do this. And people write sort of really long essays about how experience is more important. But in the other one, they wrote really long essays about how education is more important. They'll simulate selling situations where the person on the other end probably has the same sort of education, and therefore it would be important that you have the same education and you could talk about it in the selling situation. I mean, they go through amazing hoops to sort of explain how this attribute that in the other condition was stupid now is the most important thing to have when you're selling.
Were your experimental subjects of both genders or just male?
Both genders, and we don't see much difference.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, when you look, this is not my research, but when you look at a lot of research on gender bias, usually men and women look about the same. Sometimes, if anything, women can be a little more harsh in some situations toward women, but in general, it seems like there's not much of an effect.
I was just thinking that the first one seems like, so like with the exception maybe of my husband sitting next to me, right, he might not admit that, he might, you know, like I think there are a lot of guys who would be, would happily admit, haha, I took the, you know, I want the Sports Illustrated version, you know, the swimsuit thing. And so maybe in this context where you've created a situation where it's a, you, they've been asked to do it, they've been asked to do a, like a kind of an assessment, evaluation, so they think it's maybe socially inappropriate or inappropriate to tell the experimenter, I just wanted to read the swimsuit issue. So you can imagine that they're kind of very consciously sort of masking what they're doing. But I can imagine in this one that they don't really know. Like, they don't really consciously. They look at this guy and they think, maybe even non-consciously, cement manufacturing, guessing that Dan's the guy. Geez, I don't know what's more important in cement manufacturing, but intuitively my instinct, maybe even really almost like non-conscious, I go for Dan, and then I post hoc justify my intuitive decision. They just seems like two maybe different mechanisms.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in one view, it's kind of, I want to do this thing, and as I said, I scan the environment, and it's almost like an active conscious process. Like, is there anything here that can help me?
And
in the other version, it just happens. It just feels like the guy is good, and so it feels like experience is more important now. And it's very hard for us to tease them apart.
Yeah.
Because the timing of that is like probably milliseconds or something.
Right, right.
And we've actually never found a way to really tease them apart. I think both are happening, and we don't. And in this paradigm, I bet some people want to hire the guy and look around, and other people it just feels like, oh, he looks pretty good, and I bet experience is important. It's super hard for us to get which one is going on in these studies. But I think they're very different in terms of how you'd intervene to stop people from doing it. So we thought, actually, I'll show you in a sec, when we made people accountable for their decisions, we thought that would really help them stop doing this because they realize that maybe they're looking around and they should do something different, but it doesn't work so well.
Has this experiment ever been performed where the first names of each choice was gender neutral? Like
yes.
Pat?
And there we get no preference,
basically.
So we rig it so that it's baseline. And then
And are there any working hypotheses of what's going on with the people in the minority in this scenario, the ones who don't just go with gender bias? Do their responses give any clue? Do they really value education or something?
Many of them do. So people have some, bring some theory to the task, like education is important. And then, so when it's 50-50 between these, it means in some sense half the people like education and half the people like experience. Mm-hmm. And then we're trying to see off that 50-50, how many people can we drag over who used to be education people and now they're experienced people because the guy happens to be educated. But again, we don't know exactly how that's happening in their heads, but we can see in the aggregate that people are shifting over. We also can't tell, which is kind of interesting, that any given person is biased. So if you're in the 57% here, I don't know if you were someone who just liked experience better all the time, or if you're one of the people who was over there and then came over here. We can only see it in the aggregate when we look across these two different versions, and it's very, very hard for us to see actually that man or that woman is the one who's being biased, which I think is actually quite important, again, to think about how you'd intervene on these things. Yeah?
Do you notice any bias for women when you're looking at hiring in jobs that are stereotypically perceived to be dominated by women?
Yes. So actually we can see opposite patterns as well when we look in other tasks. So people will do whatever they are trying to do, they will use this kind of thinking to do it. So in fact, in some studies that we've done, we look at people who are highly supportive of affirmative action, and we'll show them a black candidate and a white candidate who are both very qualified for college. And people who are really in favor of affirmative action will pick the black candidate and do the exact same thing. People who are opposed to affirmative action will pick the white candidate and do the exact same thing. So it's actually a very flexible thing that humans have, which, depending on how you feel about different issues, they're doing a good thing or they're doing a bad thing in these situations. Do you have a question?
Yeah, but there's something interesting where they, for affirmative action, for example, you can be pro-affirmative action and genuinely supportive, or you can feel that you just should be pro-affirmative action. Mm-hmm. You can genuinely be anti-gender bias, or you can at least realize that among all my friends, I have to be that way. And I bet that the public espousal but not private espousal of the bias would be correlated with the degree to which it wouldn't change choice, but it would be correlated with the degree to which they do the post hoc rationalization, mm-hmm. right? Which is like the people who believe that you shouldn't discriminate against women show the much bigger effect in changing rank order, but may not even move on the choice.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
You know,
we've never looked at your sort of pre-existing on a scale kind of bias, and then seeing how it, because it would flip at some point.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah,
some people hate affirmative action, some people love it. People in the middle might just sort of pick randomly and not do any justification at all because they don't care. But people on the other end would, that'd be nice. Cool. I'm not going to show the data from these, but with Sam Summers, a psychologist at Tufts, who I work a lot, who's also my college roommate, oddly enough. At Tufts, we've also published a few papers showing, again, I was mentioning that you see this everywhere. So we can see it there's a tendency when there's a female defendant in trials for prosecuting attorneys to try to get all the women off the jury, and because they worry that the woman will be sympathetic to a female defendant. And what we'll see is the exact same thing. So we'll have people play the role of a prosecuting attorney, and we'll give them male and female jurors that they can decide who do you want to eliminate. You can even use peremptory challenges in these cases where you don't need to give a reason, which is crazy. It has good aspects for sure, but it's an interesting thing where you can just say, I don't like him, and throw somebody off the jury. It's a situation that's really ripe for these kinds of biases to happen because you're just sort of going with your gut and things like that. Again, we'll have, this juror has this attribute that you might not like in a juror, and this one has a different attribute. One's a man, one's a woman. Prosecutors will throw the woman off and say it's because of whatever attribute it is. And we see the same thing when we do these studies with law students and with lawyers, actually. If you have an African-American defendant, prosecutors will want no African-Americans on the jury. And same exact thing. Will vary what their disqualifying characteristic is, and they'll always throw the African-American candidate off, but say, no, it's because of something in their past or something like that. Yeah?
Did you look according to the case that you were judging? Because I think there may be some difference. If you look at bankruptcy or divorce. Mm.
That's
or
very interesting. I shouldn't say rigged, but we set it up so that it was an instance in which we suspected that there'd be favoritism, that people might believe there'd be favoritism. The black defendant was arrested under some suspicious kinds of circumstances, and the idea is that people would think, oh, that's the system is unfair, and so black jurors would let the person off. We actually started these studies so long ago that it was during the O.J. Simpson trial, where people had a theory that black people would, no matter what he did, black people would let O.J. Simpson go. Some of the ideas came from those situations where
I wanted to comment on that before you actually mentioned O.J. Simpson. At the time of the verdict, the discussion in the press was that the black jurors voted that he was not guilty because he was black, and it was seen as the black man kills the white woman, a white ex-wife. But I remember thinking there was a different variable which might have had more of an impact in the way the jurors felt, and that was that those young, relatively young people that were described and featured as jurors, they were young and happily married, and they couldn't envision a strife-filled, they couldn't envision a stalker husband. And that to me was the variable, the real variable, but it was not addressed at all in journalism, the journalistic discussion.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So from the perspective of this thing that people do in their heads, you could imagine if you're someone who thinks that the system is unfair toward black people, you would let the person go and make up a reason based on the attributes. But if your theory is something like, well, married people don't do that, or happily married people don't do that, then that would be your theory, and you'd pick other attributes or something to justify it. Because people, whatever we give people, whatever their theory is, they'll find ways to not say the real reason and sort of do it for a different reason here. I mentioned, I won't show the data here, but I mentioned that we tried to debias these things. It turns out to be very, very difficult to debias. these sorts of situations. So in one case, we said to people, this is a classic Jen Lerner and Phil Tetlock, basically we said, you're going to have to stand up and tell us why you did what you did. And we thought that people would then sort of, when they looked at the task, approach it differently and make sure that they weren't showing bias toward a woman, against a woman or toward a man in the task. And what we find when we do this is, and in retrospect it's a bit obvious, is they still show the same bias. They'll still pick the person that they wanted to pick. The only thing they get better at is making sure that they have the attribute right that favors that person. So the correlation goes up extremely high when we say be accountable, because they know we're going to come in and we're going to say, why'd you pick him? They say, education. They're really good at it then. So it doesn't actually stop them from doing it. It just actually, if anything, helps them hide it, which is a disturbing implication of how this works.
So, I mean, I think it's super fascinating and super disturbing.
Or the work?
Yeah, both. Because there are no taboo arguments, I learned. So I can say freely whatever I want. That was a joke. I'm actually building on the comment that was made earlier about kind of, you know, are there cross-cultural differences? And this is not based on research, but just kind of. So one feeling is that it's very hard to make this go away unless these arguments become untaboo. Right? There's certain taboo arguments, and think of like taboo trade-offs, there are taboo arguments you can't use. And there's, of course, a lot of speculation that political correctness in this country kind of has hurt some of the causes that it was meant to kind of foster. And just this total speculation, but it is interesting to notice in both very gender equal countries, such as the Nordic countries, that they use gender very freely and always, and it's discussed in evaluations. Mm-hmm. But also in the less gender equal European countries, like my home country, Switzerland, it's also used in a very strategic way. So, so both of those are there. But it's I'm actually finding the Nordic country more interesting, also maybe experimentally. Yeah. You know, could we untaboo something that was previously taboo in an intervention, an experiment, and maybe show that when then people are free to take this into account and people improve things?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I actually talked to a graduate student at Princeton, and she was looking at how talking about gender or talking about race, she's collecting the data now, but it was fascinating. What she was trying to show is that it's curvilinear, I guess maybe like this. So if you, if people talk a lot about race and gender, it usually means either that they're really, really liberated or really, really bad. And it's in the middle that it's sort of interesting, where should we talk about it or not. So if you constantly just refer to people as their gender and race, it can mean that you just see them as examples of that and you're really prejudiced. Or it can mean that the category has no meaning. And so it's, why wouldn't I say black or Asian or female or male, because it doesn't matter in my decisions. We did some research a few years ago on political correctness where we also thought that there may be costs to the motivation is obviously good behind it, which is don't offend people and treat people equally, but it can have these weird effects on people when they're trying to be politically correct and impede conversation and impede discourse. So we did these, we made up a game. If you ever played the Guess Who game when you were a little kid, where there's a bunch of faces and you have to play a game and guess what the person's, what face they're looking at by saying, like, does he have a mustache? Does he have that game? We rigged up a version of it where we had people play the game, and we put in some black faces into the game, so there's white faces and black faces in the game. And the first thing we thought was, there's no way people would say, is he black? Because you're not supposed to say that. And the other thing we did is we had people play with either a white person or a black person. And what you see is that when people are playing the game where, so the idea is half the faces are white and half are black. So a great question, you're trying to narrow down the set. A great question to ask is he white or is he black? Because you'll get half the faces out right there. But no one will ask the question at all, especially when they're playing with a black person on the other side. It feels really inappropriate. But the more, and so they do very badly at the game, actually, when they're playing this game. They really blow the game. In fact, we did a study with kids where in a regular version of the game, older kids, like age 10 to 12, do way better at the game than kids aged like 8 to 10, 8 to 9, because they're smarter and better at games. But in the race version of the game, the little kids dominate. And you know exactly why, because little kids are like, is he black? And they'll do really well. which actually came, Sam Summers, who I was talking about, his daughter, when she was little, was very fond of pointing at people and shouting really loudly, like, so anyway. But just to finish that point, so what we find is when adults play the game, the more they avoid it, they do worse on the game, but also their partner sees them as more racist. Because if it's half white and half black, and you're like, does he have corduroys on? The person on the other side is like, come on, this person, you're avoiding it so much, you must be racist now. So there's this bizarre calculus that you have to go through to figure out when should you say these things and when should you not. And I think we don't know, actually, what the optimal way to talk about these things is. But I hadn't thought about going cross-cultural to see when it works and when it doesn't work and why.
One of the things which is very interesting, when we think about how organizations can maximize their capacity and how their decision-making processes function, all the data for a long time now shows very clearly that the organization functions in a diminished capacity for identifying and making the most effective choice when the name is at the top or when we can see the face, right? So what's kind of fascinating is that even though this research has been out in different versions for a fair amount of time, it's very rare that organizations, other than in grading student exams, you know, we're happy to have the people who come here as like a consumer, we'll make it all equal and fair, but not the people we work with. We don't want to give that up, though it wouldn't be hard to do. And it's just sort of interesting that no one has taken that route. Have you explored that or sort of thought about what this would look like organizationally, and do you have any companies that want to try it or do it?
Yeah, so we have a little bit related to what you're saying. So I think, so every year when we interview job candidates and we interview applicants of the doctoral program, every year we say, it's funny that we're bringing people out to interview because we know this is really non-diagnostic and messes up the process.
Right.
And then we bring them out to interview.
Right.
Every single year. Everybody does this. It's a fact. It's very hard to let go of that data.
Right.
Because it feels like you need the data. And in some ways, if you're screening for, you know, is this person completely insane,
right,
it can be useful to meet them face to face.
Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. So then sometimes you don't know that either. But we are looking a little bit at, and other people are looking more at it, the idea of within organizations basically having a so in many organizations, when you do something like a diversity initiative or multiculturalism, it basically says to the white people in the organization, this is a waste of time, and I don't like this. So as soon as you say the word diversity or multiculturalism, they're out. Like, it's worse than if you hadn't done anything at all. It's really, really amazing. And it also feels discriminatory. So why are we having a diversity day for those people when we don't get any diversity? So there's a very cool paper, and now I forget who did it, but where they try to do, it's a very simple thing, but they do diversity days where every culture is honored. So like, I'm Irish Catholic, so like the Irish Catholics would bring in gross Irish food and celebrate their culture, but it's, yeah, nobody will eat it because it's boiled crap, but this was my life for my childhood. But you ever had boiled potatoes and boiled carrots? And it's like everything's boiled. Anything you could boil, that's what you eat.
It's just New England.
Maybe you're right. So there's something about, this isn't quite what you're asking, but I'm interested in this second half of how do you make it, take it off the table, where it's a little bit related to your question as well, where we're talking about these things in a broader way than
Well, it feels very saleable. If companies want to have their capacity raised, I mean, it's profitable to have the right people in the right jobs with the right skills would lead to better outcomes. We all agree. Yet we can't get over ourselves and what really is a conversation about wanting to feel comfortable, which is a stand-in for all kinds of things. But one would think that we would move in that direction at some point.
I mean, there are success stories. I mean, one that you know about is the blind auditions,
yeah,
right? That orchestra of blind auditions.
Right.
That's of course a huge success story. Now I also have to say that at least we tried. I mean, not in the academic dean. So we tried. We thought about, you know, stripping off the top part of applicants, both in our PhD program, but also as assistant professors. Now, for assistant professors, this is more than you want to know, but it's just interesting because this opens other biases, because then you know the people like you who are in your field, and I of course know Todd's work, and so I immediately recognize Todd, although his name's not there.
Right.
So it opens, you know, kind of, and his gender's not there either. But So it's a hard problem. It's a hard problem to get it right. But I agree. We probably haven't done enough to really make blind in other places.
I was reviewing a paper last night under blind review, and in the first paragraph it said, in our previous work, sort of not so blind. Yeah.
Hello, good afternoon, everybody. So my name is Tara Matthews, and I wanted to respond to your questions around organizations and companies, and because I come from the Boston Public Health Commission, and part of the reason why I was attracted to this talk is because we are actually undertaking looking at the impact of racism on first of all health outcomes. But then also, since we're projecting this idea out to the community and the programs that we fund, we're also taking a look at ourselves internally and saying, like, oh, are we a racially justice organization, or are we practicing a racial justice framework? And what we're doing as part of that is looking at our salary breakdown to see how people are getting paid and the level, the position titles. So looking at who's a director, who's a manager, who's a coordinator, and seeing what the racial breakdown is there. And that's particularly important because as a city employee, you actually have to live in the city of Boston. So we all know that living in the city of Boston is very expensive. And we also released a Health of Boston report that shows that, particular neighborhoods, you're actually, at increased risk for exposure to health hazards and things like that. So it's interesting to look at our internal data to see, are we giving our own employees equitable access to a healthy lifestyle? And what we are finding...
Let me warn you that you're being recorded.
It's okay.
Okay.
That's totally fine. Because I think what's really great about the organization is that they're not just the organization, but the mayor of Boston is really acknowledging that racism has had an impact on our health. It has had an impact not only the experience of it accumulated over time, but just, where you're likely to live based off of what access you have to income. And so I think it's a really interesting, dialogue that we're having right now, not only here, but just that, it's happening like in the city, and there's lots of stuff, and it's very controversial. And like you said about engaging a whole workplace in this conversation, it is tough, because you hear people in the coffee room, well, this is just making us have to talk about racism, and it doesn't really exist, and now we're bubbling up problems that weren't really here before. And people, if you didn't experience racism in a particular way, then it's really hard for you to engage, and then you feel like you're the one who's the perpetrator, and you can't, so it's really interesting that we're having this conversation, because it's obviously happening, it's just how do we address it, and address our ideology in society.
Yeah. Do you want to follow up?
I just want to say, so there are a lot of things kind of going through my head, but I feel like, I'm going to follow up to Victoria's question, that one, I don't know that this will change. I think in order for it to change, along the lines of race, you have to look at white privilege. Along the lines of gender, you have to look at male privilege. I don't think a lot of people in power are really comfortable with doing that. I mean, I think there was an opportunity with the like primary election and when it was, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And I mean, it was all there. Like, I mean, I think that a lot of women felt like, a lot of white women in particular felt like, this is our candidate. And a lot of African Americans felt like, this is our candidate. And people began to ask, like, why do you want to vote for Hillary? Is it just because she's a woman? Why do you want to vote for Barack? Is it just because he's black? I mean, people, and you didn't really, even if that was the reason why, you didn't really want to say it because it was like taboo.
Yeah.
Even though a lot of people felt proud of that. People felt proud of Hillary. It was like, look, she could be the first female, nothing's wrong with that. But it was like, it was that space where it's like, it's still this taboo thing. Women didn't want to honor that. African Americans, to a certain degree, didn't want to honor that until they came out to the polls and there were lines that were long of people who had never voted before who were like, you know what, I'm going to do it because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's the... when we do these experiments, they're these little—they're almost deliberately trivial. It's—I don't mean the topic is trivial, but the methodology is trivial. It's just a cutesy little flip the name thing, and we do that on purpose, actually, because the issues are so huge, in some sense that the interventions that need to be designed they're countless, and what we try to do is have these little tiny situations, sort of taken out of the big problems and say, even just on this little level, look what's happening when people make these little simple decisions. But when you aggregate these up, you have systemic problems, because if everyone is shifting a little bit from where they were to over to the right when it's a woman or a man, then we see 92% instead of 50% getting these sorts of things. I'll say one somewhat boring intervention that we've tried is, so if you look back at, when I mentioned eliminating jurors, if you look back at the reasons attorneys give, so there are some counties in the South where there hadn't been like a black juror in 30 years, even though black people were, you know, 40%, 50% of the population in the 50s and 60s and 70s and things like this. And if you look back at the reasons that lawyers gave for eliminating black jurors, what you can see is that they're completely inconsistent. So on one day they'll say, well, you know what, this guy works in a hardware store and I think he's going to be biased against something. And the next day they'll, if a white person works in a hardware store, they'll be like, well, this guy works in a hardware store, he's going to be a great juror because he has his own business. So you can look for inconsistency over time and try to get people to at least be consistent with the attributes they stated are important. And that kind of works, except let me tell you about an experiment that we ran where we tried to model this. And we told people, so we had people make an initial choice, and they wanted to pick a person on the basis of, I think this was gender, actually. So they picked a man, and they picked a man, and he had more experience. And they said, I picked him because he had more experience. And then we surprise second decision, gave them a new choice between a man and a woman, and now the woman had more experience. And we thought, ah, they're trapped, because they just said experience is more important. They picked the guy, and they said, anybody guess what they said? The guy who had more education.
Education is more important.
And how you resolve inconsistency, experience was more important
so
2 minutes ago.
We contradict ourselves all the time. It's
even worse.
They made a mistake the first time.
Even worse than that. They said diversity. So we can't have all experienced people or all educated people. We need a staff that has many, many skills. Unbelievable. And again, I don't know if it was conscious or not, but it was unbelievable to us. And it's not, it's the weird thing is it's not wrong. You could say that's true. It's just amazing how many people were able to do it. That was actually very depressing, I have to say. But okay, maybe I should,
I'm
going to go through another study quickly, but then go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that underlying attitudes are really very interesting here. And there's a notion of leveling the playing field and fairness. And I wonder the extent to which that fits in. I've heard some women who are in leadership positions say, it's really important to go for the woman candidate no matter what, because we need to level the playing field. And until we get to that point, that's the way we need to go. So it's kind of ethnic politics, gender politics in a way. And here is, I was very interested in some of your research, which shows sort of cluster hiring. If you're hiring for three positions at a time, you're more willing to have that greater diversity.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and we see in almost all the ones we do, we're doing two people against each other, and you can do these interesting things. And then in the one I just mentioned, we did two people and then two people, and people are very creative. But it's important to think about, because again, we can see in the aggregate people are being biased. We just can't see it on any one decision, but sometimes clustering up is the way to say, wait a second, across all these decisions, we're being completely inconsistent and unfair. Okay, let me switch gears. I just wanted to maybe to tell you about one of these studies. It's a different take on how we deal with doing bad things. It's a bit different, but in my mind it's very related, because ultimately it's about doing something bad and then making up a reason why it's okay. But in this case, as I said earlier, and when we look at self-deception, we're not only saying that people explain it away, but I'll actually show you that people think they're better as a result of having cheated on some dimension. So here's how, I can just skip that stuff. Here's how these studies work. They're very, again, we try to make them very, very simple. So the way it works is we have some people who take tests for us, and some people take a test. They're like Mensa questions, like these irritating questions that we're supposed to know the answer to, but I find them to be very difficult. You take this test. Some people take the test, and there's no answers at the bottom. Other people take the test, and we say, you'll see that the answer's at the bottom. You can use them to check your work as you go along. Okay? Which is just an evil thing to do, because there's no way not to look at the answers. And we did that on purpose, so we want people to cheat, in some sense, on this test. We thought these people would do better on the test than these people. That's not very interesting. But what's interesting to us is, what do they do next? So I'll show you, the way we do it is, so you take this test, or you take it with the answer key, and then you score your own test, and tell us how many you got right. And then we give you another test, that is the same kinds of questions, but new questions, and we ask you to predict how well you'll do on that test. But you can see on that test that there's no answers at the bottom. So the question is, if you cheated on test one and you did really, really well, do you say, oh, it was probably because I had the answers, I probably won't do that well? Or do you deceive yourself into saying, you know what, I'm a genius. I'm going to do really well on this test. That's the paradigm that we wanted to look at. So somebody made these animations, so I don't know what's coming up, to be honest. But So the idea is if you don't self-deceive, you do great right here, but then on test two you say, no, I'm going to look like the people without the answers again. But if you engage in self-deception, you'll continue to think that you're going to be smarter on these tests. So I'll just talk about one of the studies. So here's the sorts of questions. How many U.S. states border Mexico? They get paid for everyone they get right. And again, some people have the answers and some people don't at the bottom of the page. Then we show them, they score their own tests, they get paid. Then we show them the second test. We'll pay them for every one they get right again. They can see it doesn't have any answers. We ask them to predict how well they'll do. And the first thing that you see, which is funny, is it's out of 10. So people cheat like crazy. So they get 9 right out of 10 instead of 6 right out of 10. And they actually they take less time to do it, which is sort of funny. And you'd think that would send a signal like, wow, I got 9 out of 10 right, and it only took me 4 minutes. Maybe the answers had something to do with it. I'm going too fast. But you can see that their predictions are, they correct a little bit, so they thought it was 9, and now they're down to 8. So they're a little aware that something might have happened, but they're still predicting way better performance than people who didn't have the answers. And the problem is, of course, they do exactly the same. We see that time and time again. It doesn't change your smartness to cheat. Just people think that it does. And therefore, you have this gap, basically. And this is self-deception, is this idea that having done something bad and cheated, I now think that's who I am, and I think I'll be that going forward as well, which is a little bit silly. Let me just show you one other study quickly, because, again, as always, we want to show these and then try to de-bias them. And the way that we try to de-bias it was, imagine if after you take the first test and you cheated, and I show you the second test, and I say, I'm going to pay you for your performance on the second test, but it's not just how many you get right, it's how accurate your prediction is of how many you get right. So you'll get paid more the more accurate your prediction is. And we thought that might get people to say, well, wait a minute, maybe I got 9 out of 10 right because I looked at the answers. I don't want to lose money on this next one, so let me lower my prediction and make sure that I make more money here. It's a low-stakes way of making incentive compatible, basically. So we're pitting incentives against self-deception to see which one's stronger. Same thing as before, they take a test with the answers or not, and then they look at a second test without the answers. They make their prediction, and they can earn up to $20 depending on their accuracy. And the way it works is basically it's simple. It's we wanted to do a thing where you're motivated to get more right always, but also that the more off your prediction is, you make less per question. So the idea is if you're perfectly accurate, you get $2 for every question you get right. If you're off by one, you still make money, but you make slightly less. So where there's a curve of indifference, basically, for how people are cheating. And we wondered whether this would make people any better. Here's the results. First, they cheat like crazy again. Which we like to see. Otherwise, the experiment doesn't work. Turns out it's really easy to get people to cheat. The problem in these experiments is not the cheating part. Everyone likes to cheat a lot. They don't correct at all. So we show them the second test. We tell them, look, you're going to make less money if you don't predict correctly. No correction at all. Time and time again, people don't correct at all. And then, of course, as always, they do exactly the same on the second test, which means these people's predictions are way further off than these people's predictions. They're almost exactly right. And as a result, they make less money in the end. So the idea is that when you self-deceive, it helps you a lot at time one because you do great on a test or you do great on whatever you're trying to do. But it's costly at time two. And we actually are working on a project now. So many, many years ago, Todd sent me a reference to a book that was about, I promise this is related at some point, that is about self-made millionaires. Maybe you don't remember this, but it's basically people who have a ton of money, and it's their stories of how they got there. And they're completely fascinating because all of them have this pulled myself up by my bootstraps story. And many of them do, actually. Many of them are extraordinary, amazing people that we all wish we knew. But some of them, when you interview them, you say, you know, how did you get into the business? And they say, well, you know, I scraped all my money together and I started the business. And you say, well, what money did you scrape together? And they're like, well, I, you know, my parents gave me $200,000. And then you say, and you got a big loan, didn't you? How did you get the loan? And they say, well, my parents co-signed it. And so they worked really, really hard. It's not that they didn't, but they forgot the thing that happened that no one else in the world has access to, which is like someone can co-sign because they have a house or they have capital that they can give you. And when you're super rich, 200 grand feels like nothing. So it doesn't feel like a lot anymore, and signing a paper doesn't feel like a lot. But in my mind, that's a lot like having the answers. So it's not that they're not trying hard on the second test. They are. They still have to work on it. It's not that many, many wealthy people don't work extremely hard. Of course they do, and many of them are self-made and they're amazing. But many people have this thing where we forget that we got the answers at the bottom, at the beginning, and we go forward through life as though we never had them at all. So we're trying to think about how these things play out at a broader level when we forget that we self-deceive a little bit. And we do it because it feels better. It doesn't feel great to say, you know, I the reason I'm so successful in business is because my dad was rich. It's not interesting, you know? It's not that interesting. But it's much cooler to say, oh, we had this warehouse that we had to work out of. It's way cooler. And so you can see why people do it for these reasons. So that's one of the things that we're doing now on these lines. I'm not sure what... that is, oh, this is just funny, then I'll stop, but this is just funny. So some people, when we, there are people who will self-deceive themselves. It's in the media every so often where someone will, you'll find out that someone says they served in the military and they never did, or they say they served in active combat and they were stationed in like Plano, Texas the entire war. And we think of them as liars. And they're often actually, they really have believe it. They have like the mental imagery of having actually done it over time. Sometimes it happens where they put something on like their CV or their resume and someone's kind of reads it as, oh, you served in the war. And in the moment you say, yeah, because it feels better story to say, yeah, I definitely served in the war. And then over time people come to believe it. So you actually weirdly get rewarded when you deceive yourself in some cases. So we did an experiment where after the first test, again, you have no answers and answers. And we see what those people do. But other people get no answers and answers. And then when they're done, we give them a certificate. And we say, you were the best performer on the test in the whole world. And it says, like, it's got a seal and everything. It's really exciting. We give it to them. And those people go on to deceive themselves even more. So when the world rewards you for your deceiving yourself, it becomes instantly even more ingrained and even harder to debias over time. So it's, again, very pervasive. And little thing that we do, you just took the test, you just peeked at the answers, but then once you've done it and deceived yourself, it carries forward through time in this way. I think that might be it. Yeah, so I'm happy to take questions. Yes, in the red.
So I think about this self-deception, and I'm sure I engage in it, and I'm particularly interested around the issue of racism, you know, and white privilege that is unfolding. Dare say most of us are who are white. How do you have any rules of thumb, anything you can help an individual to think about to lessen that self-deception? Why do I walk over to, you know, if I walk to the other side of the street, or if I just have a shake of like, you know, if I see a young black guy on the street, right?
Yeah.
How do we learn from this and change?
It's incredibly hard because one of the things about self-deception is, of course, you're not aware of it. And in the moments when you are aware of it, you won't self-deceive, which starts to mess with your brain because it means we're probably doing this stuff all the time and we're not aware of it and we're self-deceiving, and then we can't back it out. It's very hard to go back and not deceive yourself having already done it because there's no signal to you from yourself that you've done anything wrong. So these people who cheated on the test, it's gone. They didn't cheat on the test. They can't go back and fix it. So it's actually quite difficult. So other people, of course, are working on ways to de-bias thought, and there's lots of interesting ways. But I don't have sort of like four keys to doing it, but I bet other people do. I bet if Mahzarin Banaji is coming in at all, I bet she has some.
No, she doesn't. She would be, I think, the first one. So Mahzarin Banaji is a psychologist who works a lot on implicit bias. So she's in the psychology department, and she developed with others kind of testing how to measure. And she would always say, you know, psychologists that's not psychologists' first kind of attempt to fix something, but it's more kind of to understand and understand the mechanisms. And so we need others. So I do think there's much more to be done. We all know this. I mean, we work in the area. do we really need some?
Yeah.
So I think your work is really at the end.
Yes.
Just building on this idea of kind of trying to correct for it, like in real life. On many of the examples you showed us, you kind of trick people. You kind of trick them into, like, you know, justifying why they've done something. Do you have many examples where you directly confront them rather than trick them? And how does that play out?
So what do you have in mind?
Well, let's take the first trivial example you said you gave with the two magazines. And you know, I'm not really into swimwear. It's just I suddenly think sports covered is much more important. I mean, do you ever kind of confront people with actually, come on, like, swimwear?
So we've tried, I mentioned just briefly, we have tried to tell people that you're going to have to explain why you did what you did to me. And that doesn't seem to help, which is close to what you're saying. But no, we haven't sort of done a, really? You know what I mean? You had 20 decisions and you hired all men. You know, really? I mean, is that really, like, we haven't actually tried that. I don't know what people, this is when you get into the things where, in organizations where when you say, look, we have a history of doing things not great and we should fix it, that half the people in the company say, so the confronting part can be good and bad. I'm not sure. But we haven't tried it. It's a nice idea. No, still you.
Well, just partly linked to it as well, you said, you know, kind of the U-shaped curve of, like, consistency and inconsistency. And actually, most people in the middle are inconsistent. They'll give one reason why they have a black guy one day, a different reason why they the next day.
Yes.
When you're at the extremes, is there more consistency? And therefore, can you use what we just talked about before to kind of tackle the extremes, as it were?
Yeah, I don't know the first part. I don't know if there's more consistency at the extremes, although it feels right that there is. That would be interesting to try, actually. What can we learn from out there to bring to the rest of us who are muddling around and not sure what to say? There's an amazing survey that I love, which is some political scientists. This is actually more in the 90s when this was much more of a hot-button issue, is whether black Americans of African descent, whether you should call them African-American or call them black. And people in conversation used to sort of not sure what to say. And there was a survey, actually, of black Americans of African descent asking, what would you like to be called? And it was almost exactly 50-50. And that's fascinating, right? Because then there isn't a right thing to say. It's completely dependent on what and like most things in life, it's completely dependent on what the person has in mind is the correct thing to say. And so in some cases, it's completely appropriate to talk about these things, and in others, it's completely inappropriate. In the game that I mentioned, the Guess Who game, we also did some versions where you didn't start, where your partner started. And if your partner starts and your partner is black, if they never say black, then people, literally 0% of people will ever say black when it's their turn to go. But if your black partner says, is he black all the time, like 80% of white people will then say, is he black, because now they feel liberated to say it. So amazing. I mean, and they're huge. In most of our experiments, we get these tiny little things going on like this. This was an effect that was enormous, which I think shows how much people are looking for what is the right thing to do. Can you please just tell me what I should be saying and doing? I feel much better about it, if you would. Yes, in the way back, on the floor.
Have you tried doing that in other countries as well? I'm Canadian. when I was growing up, like, you can't call them African American because they're not American. So, an African Canadian just really doesn't roll off the tongue very well. I called everyone black when I was growing up. Uh-huh. Or you could, once in a while, you call them by, you know, what country their parents are from or their grandparents are from, whatever it was. But most of the time, you didn't really know.
Yeah, I mean, so in some countries, the issues are not as extreme, where you're allowed to call people things and it's okay. Many countries have a or two minority groups where it's unclear what they used to be called this, and it's not clear if that's okay anymore or if they should be called this as well. So it does vary from country to country. The states is certainly, at least certain parts of the United States, are among the outliers of we should really be concerned about what we're calling people. Which is easy to make fun of, but again, it's a good impulse, which is maybe we should not call people things they don't want to be called. It's just the answer is sometimes very, very hidden. There's this great, this is totally off topic, but this great Louis C.K. bit, who's my hero in the world. He's a comedian, and he's talking about Native Americans, and he says, like, when white people came to America, like, I don't know, he says like a million years ago or whatever because he's joking, but he says they showed up and they were like, hey, you guys are Indians, right? This is India. And they were like, no, no, we're not. We're definitely not Indians, I promise. And they were like, he said the white people were like, no, 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 you're Indians. And they were like, no, we're really not. And then he goes, and we still call them that. Which is amazing, actually, if you think about not to change after 500 years. No, 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 you're still them. Yes?
This is a little bit related to that, and I don't know if you know or have some insight into this, but on the self-deception, I'm wondering about the people who cheat on the test, is it that they literally cheat and they have a blackout, they don't remember they cheated? Or do they think it's not cheating? And I'm thinking of the college, you know, because I didn't get clear instructions, or they told me to check my work but didn't say I couldn't look in advance, or do they know that they're cheating but they go on to the next step?
It's hard for us to know because, again, just like with the other stuff, the timing is so... So let's say I cheat on purpose and then a second later,
right,
I'm smart.
Right.
It's hard for us to know. But we did do one study, which was pretty funny, which was people took it on a computer. Some people no answers, some people answers at the bottom. Other people, the tasks for the answers at the bottom, but to see the answers, you had to swipe your mouse, and then they would show up. And then if you swiped it back, they would hide again, and then swipe it, and they'd show up. And what happens there is that people cheat just as much. Everyone swipes and looks at the answers like crazy, but they're a little bit better at correcting. For the next test. So they're a little bit, it sends some signal to them, like maybe the fact that I had to keep swiping every single question means I'm not that smart, but it doesn't fix them. So it doesn't actually totally de-bias them. Even that's a stronger signal than you will ever get in the world that you're cheating and maybe deceiving yourself. Even that helps, but it doesn't get people back to baseline. And this is a test that, you know, they don't care about. It's an experiment. In the real world, our motivation to do this is so, so high that it's a little bit disturbing to think about how you would possibly get people to stop. And it's not, by the way, it's not the worst thing to deceive yourself sometimes. So there's some research, you know, if you have slightly positive illusions about yourself, that can be good for your well-being. It's not horrible. If we had an accurate view of who we were, it would be hard to get out of bed, honestly, in the morning. It's good to be like, everyone likes me, you know? Everyone at work thinks I'm great. Absolutely not. At least 30% don't like me. So it can be good to do this. I was talking to this guy, Jordan Peterson, and he was saying that he's very against the idea that positive illusions are good for you. And he said, maybe they're good for you, but try being married to someone with positive illusions, which I think is an interesting test case of the breakdown of those. Yes. So this isn't my work, this is work of other people. Vicky Plout is someone who does a lot of work in this area. But in general, so there are words that are bad in current discourse. So for example, the word redistribution is a very bad word now. It just means like to take something and put it somewhere else. But now if you say redistribution, it's like you're a socialist. So there are words that get tagged with real emotion and real meaning. And diversity is one, and multiculturalism is one. So when you say we're doing a diversity initiative, and maybe it was your experience and other people's experience, many people say I'm out. And they just check out and they get mad and they say this is just creating more problems when we do these things. And the idea is to reframe these kinds of initiatives as we're celebrating all of us as who we are as people. And it sounds very cheesy and whatever, but there's a little bit of data that can work better. But part of it is just don't use these words that signal to people, like we're doing a diversity day, which means you're not diverse. It's not a, you know what I mean? We're doing a day for tall people, and you're like, whoa. That's how it feels to white people in some sense, is that they're being told, like, this is not for you. And the idea is to say, no, this is for us, kind of as an organization. But it's very difficult to implement. That's not like once you do that, everything's fine. What am I supposed to stop, by the way? I don't know.
We have until the top of the hour.
Okay, great. You had your hand up a while ago.
Do you believe, as I have concluded, that a certain amount of...
You're kind of setting me up to agree.
I'm not good at designing experiments, but through my own thinking, do you think that a certain amount of xenophobia is hardwired into the DNA?
That's a hard question. We are definitely hardwired to see differences between people. So very, not my research again, but very, very young kids will be able to differentiate between gender and ethnicity. And we also do it very, very quickly, like a matter of milliseconds. We identify someone's ethnicity and someone's gender and things like that. So the recognition is for sure there. But the idea that from that has to come treating people differently, the data is not as clear. So we don't know. We definitely have something in us that's groupy. You know, it's us versus them,
right,
for sure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But we don't know really. We don't have the test case where children are raised in the absence of anything because we can't do that as experimenters. So
in evolution, you could imagine that perhaps there was a survival advantage in the tribal era. This is my tribe and that's not my tribe. I better be careful.
Yeah. So the example that I often use, and again, it's because I'm Irish Catholic, but that these boundaries are so flexible around what is good and what is bad. So if you look at cartoons of Irish Americans, like at the turn of the last century, they were drawn with simian features,
right,
like they were apes, basically, Irish people who came to America. And now, of course, different groups are drawn with simian features. It's a common thing through history, but no one thinks of Irish people are sort of drunk and whatever, but they're not inhuman in the way that they were once seen as inhuman.
Right.
So the barriers around what is the group and what is not the group are quite flexible, which suggests that it doesn't have to be that way, but it's very hard to know. Very hard to know. Yes?
The question I have is, like, when people were taking those exams and they were cheating, and then all of a sudden they got a certificate, did anybody ever, like, for lack of a better word, feel shamed or come clean or say, hey, I mean, look, what happened? Nobody.
Sorry, I shouldn't nod so cavalierly. They may have felt ashamed, but nobody said, oh, wait, I didn't actually deserve the certificate and gave it back. And I promise you, if I gave you a certificate right now, you would never turn it down. Certificates are awesome. It's got the signature and everything on it. And they're deadly. I mean, social recognition is deadly. It's such a powerful thing for us. It leads us to do unethical things.
It's like it's one thing to cheat on, on the exams, but then to actually get something to be rewarded for it. I mean,
yes.
I feel like, oh my gosh, I cheated.
Yeah. I think people feel, people cheat on their exams, they cheat on the SATs, they pay people to take them for them, and then they get into a fancy school because of that. They may, I'd imagine they feel some compunction, but it's clearly not enough to prevent the behavior. And my guess is you say, well, that test is stupid anyway. It doesn't, it shouldn't count as much as my other stuff, and so it's probably not cheating. You know, I think we're so good at doing this. There'd be much less cheating if we had this feeling. Yeah.
At some point, people will need their biases to be shown to shift depending on the commonalities you have with them. And they're feeling like, I'm thinking of my husband, who's this tall black man with dreads, but he's an elementary school teacher. And initially, he's always that person who people are like, I don't really want them around my kids. And then they're like, oh, he went to Yale. Okay, he's a good boy. They're like, oh, he's married. Okay, so he's accountable. Oh, he's a father. Okay. That thing where it's like, he's a tall black man at first. It's like, I want to clutch my purse, but then he's all right.
Yeah, I think, and so Claude Steele, a psychologist, not at Stanford anymore, Columbia now? I forget. He's back at Stanford. Who's African American, wrote a paper called Whistling Vivaldi. It's an extraordinary way to signal that you're not that, you're the other good group. So yeah, it's quite interesting to think about what are the characteristics. But now I should stop.
Please join me in that. Thought-provoking talk at many levels, very micro, but you took us up to the organizational very easily. Now, I hope you all will join us next Thursday. Kathy Phillips, professor from Columbia Business School, is going to talk with us about some new research on can female leaders mitigate negative effects of diversity in the case of national leaders. So we hope you'll come back for that. Thank you all very much.
Kathy Phillips is awesome.
She's awesome. She's really awesome. Yeah. Yeah, she's excellent. Thank you.
Where'd you grow up?
Here.
You did, you're kidding me. Arch Catholic
is
covered.
I'm so sorry.
I don't know.
Oh, no, I totally understand. No, I mean, my son's preschool teacher said to me at the beginning of this year, and you can bring some food. I married the boss, and I'm like, I don't know. I didn't even make that.
Wait, are you in this R&R?
But where did you go?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this. You did a great job.
It's not good.